Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Sine. This is a very special episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast. We're going to be talking about contract software development in Europe. And I'm here in Prague in the Czech Republic right now. And in this episode, we'll be discussing software development in Europe with several different companies working with clients globally. And I think you'll find this to be really interesting because we do live in an era of global technology, global software development, and so working with developers around the world and across cultures is definitely a very important topic. And so that's what we're going to discuss today in the European context. And then in an upcoming episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast, we'll also talk about it more in the Latin American context, which if you are familiar with my work and what we do at Agility Feet, then you already know that we do contract software development in Latin America for clients globally. So you might be wondering, why am I here in Europe? Well, it's because I almost lived here in Prague about 15 years ago. And so I'm going to start this episode with just a brief little personal story about that. About 15 years ago, I was working with a software development agency, and we were bidding on a project in Europe for a major client there. And unfortunately, we didn't win that project. But if we had, then I was going to move to Prague and help start operations there for that company. So I got really excited about this, and my family did as well, about the possibility of living in Prague. Our sons were young at the time, and we kind of explained to them where that was, and we were learning a lot with them about what it might be like to live in the Czech Republic. And as I said, unfortunately, we didn't win that bid. And so at first, I was really disappointed about that. But my wife, Lauren, she was the first one to say, well, you know, the one thing we didn't like about the idea of moving to Prague is that it gets pretty cold there. And we're not really cold weather people. She said, but the idea about building a software company like this is a great one. What if we did it in Latin America or the Caribbean, somewhere warmer? That was very interesting to me. And that conversation led to working with my business partner, David Alfaro, in Costa Rica, and then eventually building software development teams across Latin America for clients in the U.S. So Prague holds a special place in my heart because I did almost live here. And if I had, then maybe now, 15 years later, my second language would be Czech instead of Spanish. Certainly life would be different, I'm very happy with the life that we've built with building teams in Latin America. But nonetheless, it's very interesting for me to be here in the Czech Republic and exploring Prague and thinking about what might have been. But beyond just that sentimental journey, I do think that this context of software development in Europe is incredibly important to many companies, not only in Europe, but around the world. And so you'll see that the people I talk with work with clients around the world, including in the U.S. And so in this episode, we're going to explore more about software development in Europe. So join me for this journey in this very special episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast. And if you're not already, please do subscribe to us on the podcast platform of your choice and social media, and check us out at scalingtechpod.com, where we'll have more notes from this and all of our episodes available for you. So let's get to talking about software development in Europe.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
I've interviewed two companies as part of this episode. One is First Line Software in the Czech Republic, and the other is Hire Odessa, a U.S. company that is made up of Ukrainian developers. Over the course of our conversations, we talked about things like how they work with U.S. clients, how they differentiate themselves in the global technical workforce, how AI is affecting their work, and how the war in Ukraine has affected their work. First, I'll start with an introduction from each guest, where they'll introduce themselves and their companies to give you some context for the rest of the conversation. I'll begin with Val Narodetsky from Hire Odessa.
Odessa is a remote tech team concierge agency. So we primarily work with US-based businesses, helping them hire top-tier talent from Ukraine, including developers, engineers, analysts, IT specialists, and so on. This allows them to save significant amounts of money on the hiring costs, and while also without sacrificing on the quality output of that talent.
And tell me a little bit about the origin story of the company, you know, when and why it was founded.
Yeah, so Odessa is my fifth venture. Prior to starting this company, I had four other companies that I was able to scale in the past 12 years with two successful exits. Most of the background experience has been primarily focused mainly in e-commerce as well as consumer goods space. However, during the past decade or so, we were primarily focused on hiring Ukrainian talent, just because I'm originally from Ukraine. I immigrated to the United States in 1998. So having the ability of speaking the language, knowing the culture and understanding how things operate over there gives me a bit of a leg up in terms of managing and hiring the right talent. So after selling my most previous venture about a year and a half ago, I found myself a bit bored and looking for something else to do, just because I firmly believe that I still have juice in the tank, so to say. One of my very good friends, they have a substantial pet company doing about 30 million top line revenue. And when we were having dinner, he mentioned to me that they're really struggling with hiring their tech department for the expansion of the business, and that they had a very significant pain point of working with another recruitment agency for the past 2.5 months and not being able to really find anybody worthwhile of their consideration, because they were ultimately looking to hire a senior tech as well as two junior leads. So I decided to just, you know, take a look at under the hood and see what was the issues. So we did an assessment for them. And long story short, within I believe it was about 3 weeks' time, we were able to find a highly qualified team lead for them and two junior leads out of Ukraine, essentially just, you know, staffing the entire department in less than a month, whereas they were struggling with that same process for 2.5 months via another agency. So at that point, it was combination of kind of like an aha moment. Then I might be onto something here, just because I've done this sort of process for my previous companies. But at the same time, just because of the positive experience, one introduction led to another client, another introduction led to another client. So it really was a very organic path to growth. It wasn't really something that I even envisioned starting, but it landed in my lap. And after doing some, you know, some soul searching as well as some market research, I figured, why not? You know, I'm originally from Ukraine. I consider myself to be a serial entrepreneur. For the past 12 years, I've been hiring out of Ukraine for all sorts of tech roles. So the knowledge is certainly there. And why not productize it and offer it to the market here in US? And so far, it's been an amazing ride. We started about 2.5 months ago, and each month have been just doubling in business. So the response has been tremendous. So it certainly is on a good trajectory. And I really do believe that as this company grows, as we start offering new ways of hiring overseas talent, this could be a big business.
Next, we'll hear from Alexander Pozniakov, COO of First Line Software.
My name is Alex Pozniakov. I work as a Chief Operating Officer for First Line Software, and we are now in the Czech branch of our software, of our company, and in custom software development business more than 20 years. And in this company, we'll be celebrating the 15th years of existence in late December this year.
Fantastic. Congratulations.
Thank you.
That's a huge milestone for sure. So tell me a little bit more about when and how it was founded.
This company was founded in December 2009, and the reason for that was very simple. We have a pretty successful business in software development, and the company was sold. And as a management, we were bound to stay with the company as an officer for 3 years. And after this period was over, we understand that we have no other ideas just to do the custom software development. So we started in another company, and by 28th of December 2009 in this company works 3 people, and by end of January it's already 40, and they started growing and growing and growing again.
Fantastic. So you were one of the founding members then
Yes.
of the company. Yeah, I can appreciate it coming from a custom software development background myself. I've tried to work on some other things at times in the past, but it always just comes back to custom software yeah. development for me. Just what I'm drawn to, I guess. So I definitely appreciate that. Tell me a little bit more about the size of the company, and are you all here in Prague?
No, we are distributed quite extensively across the Europe and across the globe. We are slightly over 500 people, and we have major offices in the United States, in Boston, in the United States, in San Francisco, and that office is more on the sales and marketing offices there rather than mm-hmm. development, but we are starting to move our engineers to the United States, and we are growing our presence in the United States in terms of engineering workforce. We have offices in Netherlands, in Germany. Mm-hmm. We have 2 offices in Czech Republic. Recently, we started office in Slovakia, in Bratislava. And the biggest office so far, as of today, is in Montenegro.
Montenegro. Okay, very nice. That's fantastic. That's a wonderful geographic spread you have there.
It's about the offices, but if you talk about the people, we have people in Vietnam, we have people in Thailand, we have people in Colombia,
yeah.
we have people in Spain, so in Serbia, so we have people almost everywhere in the world.
So the team can work hybrid. You have offices in those 6 or 7 locations that you listed, but
now after the COVID, everything work hybrid,
right.
unless you face a client face to face. So we don't have a front office because we are in the software development. So, and mm-hmm. we have offices where the people can come and work through from the office. But we are hiring excellent engineers wherever we find them.
To my surprise, each of the companies that I spoke with does most of their business with clients in the US. For Val from Odessa, this makes sense because while his team is currently primarily from the Ukraine, his company is based in the US. Alex from Firstline Software also explained the obvious reason why most of their work is in the US.
It's a well-known particular reason for that, because the U.S. is the biggest market in the world. So that's,
fair enough.
Yeah.
Are there, I guess what I'm curious about, are there any challenges that either unique benefits or challenges that cause that difference between 80% in the U.S. and then 20% in Europe, but I think you said mainly in the U.K.?
I think the main reason for that is we would like to have more business from Europe, but mm-hmm. Europe is very fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a very long history and work with a client in Germany, but we are mm-hmm. just starting to make the first steps to expand our presence in Germany beyond this client.
Mm-hmm.
And in each country in Europe, you have to have your own sales. So in Germany, you have to invest in sales. In Germany, in Netherlands, in France.
Right.
You have to invest, and it's very fragmented.
Yeah.
And every market is smaller than US.
Right.
US, you invest in the sales and marketing, and you get, you know, the faster benefits out of it.
Yeah, so that's, absolutely.
So it's quite natural reason. We are small company.
Mm-hmm.
At least we are still feel ourselves as a small startup-like company. So we are very cautious about where we invest, how we invest.
This was an interesting conversation for me, since I had not thought of business in Europe that way, as a fragmented market, as Alex described it. In the US, of course, we have a wide range of cultures and some variation in laws from state to state. And although we might joke sometimes that the US is like 50 different countries, our business culture is much more homogenous than Europe. With different business cultures as well as different languages, it's a much more fragmented market. And so, of course, that makes it easier for many European firms to focus their effort on the US as the largest single tech market in the world. Before we go further, though, I want to define a few terms, especially the term nearshoring, which I use a lot when describing how how I work and how our teams work at Agility Feet. For me, time zones have always been a big deal in our work at Agility Feet. We work primarily with clients in the US for our staff augmentation projects, with most of our development team drawn from Latin America, since it's a strong pool of talent that sits in the same time zones. For clients in Western Europe, they can easily work with teams in Eastern Europe or Africa and get the same sort of time zone benefit. Generally speaking, working with clients in your same time zone is referred to as nearshoring, as opposed to offshoring, which generally refers to working with a team in further time zones. Outsourcing and offshoring in technology has been around for a long time, and I've seen many different versions of it in the course of my career over the last three decades. The original offshore locations were India or other parts of Asia, and the original driving force was all about price. It was assumed that if you just specify the requirements for software in enough detail, that you could hand it off to anyone, anywhere, and they would return completed software that meets those requirements. This was not a great assumption, and the next faulty evolution of offshoring was to, quote unquote, follow the sun. Instead of having a core team in the US working for 8 hours, for example, and then a team working in India overnight, you could position teams around the world so that each 8 hours, work is handed off from one time zone to the next, effectively allowing 24 hours of continuous work and, in theory, higher productivity. Now, following the sun can work well for some job functions, such as technical support, where the work is discrete and it's finished well within the confines of a single work shift. But for software development and other more complicated technical projects, following the sun is a disaster that can only sound good in a waterfall-based management mentality. The frequent handoffs between different individuals inevitably led to bad software that not only didn't match the requirements, but also the low quality of the work tended to more than offset any cost benefits. Now, thankfully, these notions became antiquated with the advent of agile software development beginning in the early 2000s, which says that software development should not be constrained by intense upfront requirement gathering. While having a vision for the software you want to build is obviously important, it's impossible to specify all of the details up front and just hand it off to someone to be manufactured to spec like a car. Software development is inherently more creative work. And so it should be done in short iterations of work with frequent customer feedback. This much more collaborative form of work is harder to do across wide-ranging time zones, which is a main benefit of nearshoring, because you're in those same time zones, and so you can be more collaborative as you work together. But nearshoring is not the only way to address the time zone concerns in a modern software development environment. In this next clip, Alexander talks about the value of doing some on-site work.
If we talk about the customer-facing roles, as close you have them to clients, that's better.
Right.
Because you know, they have to breathe the same air. They have to talk the same language. So basically, for these two projects, all management of this project are close to client. It's our engineers, so they travel there, they relocate there, but they're very close to client. You cannot do such projects on a very distant mode because you may deliver something that client don't expect and don't want to have.
That doesn't mean that teams can't still work remotely, though. Most of their work remains hybrid, and as long as those customer-facing roles are closer to the client, much of the engineering work can still be done in further time zones, in Alex's experience. In other cases, instead of staff augmentation or project work, the contract model for remote teams is more of a pure, like a pure recruiting company. This is one of the business models that Odessa uses, where Val's team will help quickly source the senior talent that a client needs. But then in many cases, that technical talent will be contracted with or hired directly by the client. Odessa's paid a recruiting fee, and then the client is responsible for continuing management of the staff. So which model is better, staff augmentation or project-based? It depends on what the client wants, which is why many companies, including my own, offer both models. Alex told me that most of their work is building staff augmentation teams that work side by side with client teams, but that their project-based work is growing. For Val's team at Odessa, he offers the pure recruiting model I described a moment ago, as well as what he calls a subscription model, which is like a staff augmentation model, but with a base monthly fee that allows for unlimited recruiting.
The primary and the most popular one that we've had is our a la carte recruitment. This is where we come in as your headhunter, where you give us your project scope, who you're looking to hire, how many people you're looking to hire, and the quality that you're looking for. And then we go to work, right? So we send you an engagement letter. Once everything is signed, my team basically reaches out to our proverbial boots on the ground, no pun intended, right, on the Ukrainian borders, and we start scouring and looking for that right talent. Our current timeline of, you know, between the engagement letter signed to actually presenting the target client with at least two potential candidates is around 14 days. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer just because of the complexities and, you know, client preferences, things like that. But from what we've seen right now, it's been about a 14-day period where within essentially 2 weeks, you're getting 2 to 3 candidates that are almost a perfect match for the project that you're looking to do. So that's a la carte recruitment. This is kind of like a traditional recruiting model that we've been focused on. The second one, this is actually just came by demand of some of the clients that we're working with, is their need to always be hiring. So they came to us and they said, listen, Val, you know, my company is growing incredibly aggressively, and I'm always looking to hire. I'm a big fan of remote tech teams. Instead of paying you a headhunter fee for every time I have to contact you, is there a possibility to have an ongoing relationship similar to a subscription business? So that kind of evolved into what we call remote teams unlimited, where for $999 per month, you get access to us 24/7. You have an account manager assigned to your account, and you are just, you know, you reach out to us anytime and you say, hey, I need a Python developer, or I need a Shopify developer. And we get that for you within, like I said, within 14-day period.
If your team is looking for a very specialized talent or talent that is hard to find, then staff augmentation is a good way to go. For example, our team at Weber TC Ventures are experts in video application development, which is a very niche skill. You might want that skill set in your team during the crucial phases of a video-based project, but maybe you don't need that skill set for the long term, so you don't want to make it a permanent hire. Or you tried to hire for it, but WebRTC Video is such a narrow skill set, you couldn't hire someone. That's a great use case to augment your team with an experienced WebRTC engineer from our team for a flat monthly fee. Or the more common use case is that you want to do staff augmentation for engineering talent because it's too difficult or expensive to hire the developers yourself. That's another great use case for staff augmentation and something we do in our company at Agility Feet, as do both of my guests discussed in this episode. Okay, so now you know what nearshoring and staff augmentation are, but do you do it for pricing reasons or because of a talent shortage of some kind? This is a question I asked both of my guests with similar answers. Val talked about how his clients are coming to him first because they want high-quality talent that they're struggling to find in the U.S.
Honestly, they're coming to us for quality. They're more quality-focused, and the cost savings acts as a cherry on top. It makes our process very easy to sell to a potential client because, given Ukraine's reputation as far as, you know, one of the primary drivers of tech talent on a global scale, at least prior to war, the clients that we've interacted with are fully aware of the quality output differences between Ukrainian tech talent, specifically engineers, and US-based. So when we were having conversations, the conversation regarding, hey, how much money am I going to save, is actually secondary. The first one is, I'm looking for somebody who's really good, that knows what they're doing, somebody who can work directly with me or with my, you know, chief of staff. And then obviously that rolls into, I don't want to work with, you know, US-based engineering talent for this particular project just because the quality has been poor. The expectations of what would be the proper term, the expectations of raises and promotions are extremely high. And that just translates into an unpleasant experience overall. So that's why from our conversations so far, whether it's a CTO or, you know, VP of engineering, they are very focused on bringing somebody from outside who can turn out much better quality. And then the savings of all also come with being part of that region of the world, I guess.
But pricing is not entirely out of the discussion either. It's just usually the secondary benefit of working with one of these companies. Val also explained the type of pricing benefits his clients see by working with his teams in the Ukraine.
On average, we're seeing about 60 to 70% cost savings in terms of, you know, apple-to-apple comparison. The requirements for a U.S. company to bring on a full-time, let's say, Python engineer, right? Their hourly rate requirements, as well as the payroll costs, the tax associated costs and things like that, versus just bringing somebody from Ukraine and just contracting them out from overseas is approximately, yeah, about like 60 to 70% cheaper. That also translates into hourly pay, right? Because of a lot of talent that we're connecting with our clients is either on salary base levels or hourly base levels. So the hourly from our end, at most, depending on, you know, the complexity and the height of talent and so on, does not exceed $50 per hour or something similar to that. Whereas utilizing a US-based equivalent, we're going way outside of that norm, you know, sometimes reaching way beyond $100 an hour, if not more, as well as the, you know, the salaries and everything that's associated with maintaining that. So the savings are tremendous, 100%.
Unfortunately, deciding on an international software team to work with is not as simple as trying to just balance price and quality. Because we live in a global tech economy, geopolitics inevitably affects our work more than anyone would wish. And there's no doubt that the Russian invasion of Ukraine has made a dramatic impact on software development in Eastern Europe. Ukraine has been known as a great place to find technical talent in Europe, but the war has changed that, sadly. Val talked to me about the impact of the war on his team.
One thing I can tell you is that it's really, you know, on a personal level, it's really hard to see what these people are going through, especially on trying to work with them, despite their desire to, you know, to contribute, to really make a mark in, on a global scale from the tech development perspective. One of, you know, because we're always interviewing, we're always onboarding new talent that's within Ukrainian borders. And we had a potential client who was looking for an engineer. We found one, a highly qualified guy. And the day of the interview, when we were supposed to meet, he sends me on Slack a message, "Hey, we are under drone attacks right now. I am unable to meet come to the meeting to have an interview with this potential employer because there's drones literally above our heads and there's air raid sirens." And it's like, how heartbreaking is it, you know? So it certainly had an effect.
Stories like this are not unusual in Ukraine, unfortunately, and the scope of the human impact is staggering. Val talked about the overall impact on the size of the Ukrainian tech community.
You know, it's tough, right? We shouldn't beat around the bush. This is a very difficult situation. The problem is that, you know, prior to the war, Ukraine's engineering output in terms of people graduating with some kind of computer science degree was approximately 250,000 people per year. For the country of Ukraine size, that's pretty substantial, which puts them really up there in terms of providing that sort of specialized talent on a global scale. After the war right now, because of the issues with infrastructure and everything that's been going on around there and all the atrocities, that number has reduced down to almost by half, about 130,000. With that said, though, Sequoia Capital actually just published a white paper not too long ago related to a study of, you know, how has the tech sector in Ukraine has been affected by the war. What's surprising to me was that, according to them, over 84% of Ukraine's tech talent is still employed in some kind of capacity, whether it's through leaving the country and just working out of, let's say, neighboring country like Poland or Moldova, for example, or just really just staying within the borders of Ukraine and actually maintaining contracts.
This human suffering is horrible. And personally, I can't imagine being worried about keeping your job and doing good work. At the same time, you're also worried about the safety of your family and the very survival of your home country. We're fortunate in the U.S. to be far enough from the situation that we have the luxury to put it in the back of our minds. But I can tell you that the war is very top of mind for technology professionals across Europe. And it was a frequent topic of conversation at the tech conferences I recently attended in several European countries. I've met multiple people over the last few years who talked about the upheaval of trying to move family members away from war, of trying to move to areas where they can continue to work, as well as heart-wrenching stories of team members who have died in the war in Ukraine. Despite these challenges, it's also remarkable to see the resilience of the Ukrainian people impacted by the war. Val talked about some reason for optimism.
On a more positive note is that given that the current situation is a little bit more isolated towards the kind of the eastern side of Ukraine for the majority of part, and I think that's kind of like in correlation to the Sequoia Capital's white paper, about 80% of interviews that we're having, our first question is, are you in a safe zone? Are you located anywhere where your life or your family's life might be in jeopardy, just not for, you know, the client's sake, but just for my personal sake? I'm from Ukraine, so I feel for these people, you know? So the situation has certainly affected the way that we are onboarding talent. We've certainly had clients that are showing a bit of reservations in terms of, you know, moving forward. But for the most part, like I said, about, you know, 80% of the time, it is a positive experience. And some, you know, majority of the clients, potential clients that we're having these discussions with, because we're very transparent, they show complete support. So my bet is that what I'm placing in terms of starting Odessa, my bet is that this will be over soon. And when it is over, there's going to be a huge initiative to rebuild the infrastructure, rebuild the country. And my deepest personal desire is to have Odessa be located on the forefront of that rebuilding process when the time comes.
Now, the war in Ukraine is not the only source of turmoil in the world right now, unfortunately. In addition to other heartbreaking wars in the Middle East, and conflict and division around the world, we've all just recently recovered from the COVID pandemic. These crises each have shown the importance of contingency planning. As I spoke with people around Europe during my recent travels, I was reminded of all the clauses you see in the fine print of insurance contracts. Here's an excerpt from one of the business insurance policies that my company's had. This policy does not provide coverage for claims or coverage for any amounts based upon or arising out of war, invasion, hostilities, or warlike operations, whether war is declared or not, strike, lockout, riot, civil war, rebellion, revolution, insurrection, civil commotion, assuming the proportions of or and amounting to an uprising, military or usurped power, or the confiscation, nationalization, or destruction of or damage to property under the order of government or other public authority. And that's just the section about wars. There are other parts of that insurance policy that exclude other events that we've seen in the world in recent years. Unfortunately, these risks affect more than our insurance policies. They also affect how we structure our businesses. Ultimately, we're software developers. We're not economists, epidemiologists, or experts in geopolitics. We can't be expected, and our business leaders can't be expected to have anticipated all the things that have happened in the last 4 or 5 years. However, that doesn't let us off the hook because we should expect that the unexpected will still happen. And that's why contingency planning in your projects and your business is a good idea. Where and how you staff your technical team can be part of that contingency planning. Building geographical diversity into your team should be a major part of your contingency plan, so that if a regional crisis happens, you already have teams in other locations who can help continue the work to keep your business operating. Having your whole team in one country, including even the US, sadly, is no longer a sustainable strategy. Outside of staffing, having a flexible business model and strong leadership also go a long way towards weathering global events. When you pick a region to hire tech staff in, you need to consider not just price, but any other regulatory implications of your work. Labor laws vary from country to country, and how easily you can contract with individuals without having a local operation in that country. Hiring individual contractors on a site like Upwork is great for some things, but no way to build a cohesive software development team. Val talked about the importance of having good IP protection in place in your contracts, as well as considering cultural differences.
So there's always considerations to be made, right? You're dealing with an entirely different region where the laws are different related to contract engagements, data protection, privacy. I think those probably would be the kind of the primary drivers in terms of, you know, making sure that the IP that's located within the company, whenever you're hiring somebody from Europe or overseas or Ukraine for that matter, that you're properly utilizing all necessary tools to really protect the intellectual property. At the same time, you have to be mindful of cultural differences. On the contract side, a company that's based in US should really do their homework on educating themselves in terms of kind of like, you know, I always look at things like kind of what's the worst case scenario, what's the best case scenario. The best case scenario is that I hire a rock star engineer and he doubles my outputs and, you know, the company grows profitably. The worst case scenario is engineer is hired. He turns out to be somebody shady, tries to steal company secrets, and then good luck enforcing the contract, right? So that kind of has to go into that realm. It doesn't often, but you have to be prepared as a business owner, right? So the complexities, I think, if I had to point a finger to it, there's four of them, right? So it's data privacy, data protection, IP protection, minding the cultural differences, the legal implications and jurisdictions and how those play into working with somebody on the European side, and also the tax implications, right? So depending on how the talent is hired, how the contracts are put together, those four areas should be looked at very carefully by the prospective companies that are specifically US-based, and really just doing your homework and due diligence and being proactive when you're actually moving forward.
In addition, you need to consider carefully what type of data is exchanged with your team in Europe, since there are regulations like GDPR, which handle data privacy much differently than in the US. Alex talked about how important it is in their team to try and stay away from clients' production systems.
We try to avoid any data we are hosting with our clients. So we're trying to push it out so we're not touching the production base, because it's ignite a lot of legal work. And we are too small to overcome these obstacles, because, you know, the US have their own data protection, Europe their own data protection. In every country there's slightly differences in the data protection, and we're just too small to develop something for hosting any customer data on mm-hmm. our side. So we are limit ourselves to, okay, we deliver the code, we are not touching your production base, or we're touching your production base when we are in the same territory than the customers, we are on the same law.
Alexander also stressed to me that the challenges presented by these differing regulations will not be solved by more strict laws, and that this will only get more complicated as we continue to incorporate AI into our work. So let's talk about AI in the future of software development. And Alex shared some excellent insights in this area, since they have invested in it heavily at First Line Software. But they still cannot use that knowledge with all clients due to their own unique policies and that client's comfort level with AI. In general, Alexander noted that there are two main ways that AI can help software development. The first is to increase the productivity of software developers, and the second is to make it easier to build advanced functionality in your software using Gen AI integrations, for example. Let's take each in turn. First, AI can help make your software development more efficient, which can further increase productivity and reduce costs above what you may already be getting by nearshoring or offshoring the work. Alexander explained how this is particularly beneficial to mid-level engineers and bring them closer to the quality of a senior level engineer.
It gives a lot of opportunities for people who need to grow, because AI and using any tools of AI don't make any senior more senior. But in the middle range engineers, they can make a senior. They can be performed like a senior in terms of a speed.
Yeah.
They cannot do it in the terms of experience, because experience you gain, you know, over the years on the different variants of the project, but in terms of the speed, it gives a huge opportunity, because nobody needs just a fast junior. The slower the junior are, the better, because he has a time to think. But for middle people with a 3-5 years of experience, AI is a great opportunity to become more efficient than anyone else.
Secondly, building AI into an application allows us to build features that only a few years ago were either not possible or prohibitively expensive. Alexander talked about the positive reductions in effort needed to build an application for one of their clients that includes support in multiple languages and customer support agents for a real estate company.
Very simple prototype. When it's AI-based, slightly trained about the the typical answers for this, which pick up line, talk as a human to the person, and solve, 50%. Not 80%, but 50% of the questions.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. We develop only integration, because all the components, all the modules is already available. OpenAI is available, voice generation is available. So, you know, the training part of a typical question we have about, you know, the where to find the keys, how to switch on the electricity, how it's, you know, the very basic maintenance question. So the people have when they first enter into the apartment. So it's all solved. And that's possible because just 5 years ago, if someone asked to develop this, it's a multi-million dollar project. Now, it's very simple. Okay, it's not a $5,000 project, but it's not multi-million.
Most of the talk about AI and software development concerns if AI is going to make software development obsolete. While there is no doubt that AI is already changing how we develop software, the profession is not going away. Instead, it's more likely to simply accelerate the speed at which we can build applications and open the door to new types of applications we could never build before. So developers will still matter. And as long as developers still matter, then nearshoring and offshoring software development will also still be incredibly important in mature businesses. Thanks for joining me for this special episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast, and I hope you've come away with a better idea of the market for software developers in Europe and more about nearshoring and offshoring software development in general. To learn more about any of the guests I interviewed in this episode, visit our show notes page on scalingtechpod.com. That will include links to not only a replay of this episode, but also the full interviews with each guest on our YouTube channel. Coming up in our next episode, we'll talk about nearshoring in Latin America, where we will continue to build on the concepts and best practices discussed in this episode. As I said in the introduction to today's episode, I nearly started a software development office in Prague over 15 years ago. And so the idea of working in Europe has always been interesting to me. But instead of building my company there, I've built up a team in Latin America for nearly 15 years now. And in our next episode, I'll share more with you about what I've learned, as well as include interviews with other experts I've worked with. So thanks again for listening to this episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast. Be sure to share it with others in your organization and subscribe to us on social media and the podcast platform of your choice.